Imagine for a moment you're caught in a financial dispute, maybe with your bank, maybe an insurance company. You feel like you've hit a brick wall, right? You're overwhelmed, maybe outmatched. So you turn to what's supposed to be your last resort, an independent authority, someone neutral, set up to deliver fairness. But what happens when that very authority, the one you're relying on, is accused of consistently failing the people it's meant to protect? Year after year. That's the critical, hard-hitting question we're diving into today. We're doing an unflinching examination of the Australian Financial Complaints Authority, AFCA, and specifically, we're looking at some deeply concerning allegations made against it in a recent, really detailed submission. Our source for this deep dive is a comprehensive document submitted to an AFCA review written by Michael Sanderson. It doesn't pull any punches. It focuses right in on the outcomes of AFCA's resolution of complaints. So our mission today is to unpack these pretty significant claims, look closely at the specific evidence provided in the submission, and really try to understand what it all means for, well, the consistency, the predictability, and ultimately the quality of AFCA's outcomes for you, the consumer.
Yeah, what's really fascinating here, I think, is how this submission just cuts straight to the core of AFCA's whole purpose. I mean, as an external dispute resolution scheme, AFCA is fundamentally designed to be an accessible, fair process for consumers. Simple as that, supposedly. But this document, it's packed with detail, specific case studies, and it doesn't just ask questions, it directly challenges the basic assumptions about how financial disputes are meant to be resolved in Australia. It's a really critical look at whether the system is actually working the way it should.
Okay, so if AFCA is meant to be this crucial safety net, what did its founding principles actually promise? Let's unpack that. Our source takes us back to 2018 when AFCA was officially authorized by Minister Kelly O'Dwyer under the Corporations Act 2001. And this authorization, it was crucial, right? It came with this understanding that mandatory requirements in Section 10 of 51 of that act would be strictly met. And Section 105(1) of the act, it seems pretty clear. Complaints against scheme members, including any final determinations, must be resolved in a way that is fair, efficient, timely, and independent. It wasn't just a guideline, was it? It sounds like a foundational legal promise baked into AFCA's structure.
Well, yeah, and that immediately brings up a very serious question. Because the submission flat out alleges that AFCA has not met these requirements. It makes a direct accusation saying AFCA is in breach of the Corporations Act, claims its outcomes are not fair, efficient, timely, or independent. And on top of that, the submission asserts AFCA fundamentally lacks the appropriate expertise even to make sure these vital parts of the act are met consistently. It's a huge challenge to that initial ministerial go-ahead that authorized AFCA. It suggests a really concerning, maybe systemic, disconnect between the intent and the reality. A fundamental betrayal of its mandate, if true.
And what's really striking, I found reading this report, is the submitter's next claim. They argue AFCA actually is consistent, just maybe not in the way you'd hope. They argue AFCA is capable of producing consistent and predictable outcomes, but with a specific, and for consumers, pretty unsettling pattern. And to back this up, they cite this incredibly telling data point. It's from Gerard Brody, the CEO of the Consumer Action Law Center, CALC. He found that out of all home lending complaints made to AFCA back in 2020, not a single one resulted in a finding favoring the consumer. Zero. The submitter then reinforces this with their own experience and others they know, saying their outcomes were, and I quote, again, 100% consistent and predictable. The implication is pretty stark, isn't it? If you're a consumer in one of those situations, you can apparently consistently predict you won't win.
And if we connect that to the bigger picture, the submission argues the quality of these outcomes is seen in totally different ways. It creates this deep divide. So from a consumer point of view, are AFCA's resolutions quality? The submission suggests the answer is a clear no. But, and this is the submitter's suspicion, the AFCA members themselves, you know, the financial firms facing the complaints, they typically say yes, absolutely. It just highlights this fundamental split in how AFCA's effectiveness and fairness are perceived. Like one system, two completely different realities depending on where you stand.
Right. And this is where the argument really digs in, because the submission gives us this incredibly detailed case study. It involves complaints 620007 and 647775. And it uses this case to illustrate the allegations with specific hard evidence. So the scenario starts with the submitter alleging maladministration in lending, loan management, and security matters. And this relates to what they claimed was a major overvaluation of their property by the Bank of Queensland, BOQ, when they got a business term loan, a BTL. So it wasn't just about one bad valuation, apparently. It was about alleged systemic problems with the bank's actions and then how AFCA handled the complaint itself.
Yeah, and this specific case tackles AFCA Rule CY1.3 head on. Now, this rule generally says AFCA can't look at complaints that are only about a bank's credit risk decision. Unless, and this is the key part, the complaint is about maladministration. And maladministration, well, basically means things like procedural mistakes, misconduct, not following proper process rather than just, you know, alone going bad commercially. The submitter's core argument here is that AFCA deliberately misinterpreted this rule to protect the banks, essentially, and penalize the consumers. So in the preliminary assessment for this case, AFCA said it, quote, cannot consider a complaint that relates solely to a bank's assessment of the borrower's credit risk. And they claimed the bank only had to assess whether the loan was affordable, not whether the security actually covered the debt or the investment risk involved. But crucially, and this is telling, the word maladministration, which was the very exception that should have let the complaint proceed under C.1.3, that word was apparently never even mentioned or discussed by AFCA in the preliminary assessment.
Okay, so a very pointed claim there about AFCA allegedly just sidestepping the whole maladministration issue. And then we get to this really crucial piece of evidence mentioned in the submission, an unsolicited industry expert report. This report, it was commissioned by the Australian Small Business and Family Enterprise Ombudsman, ASBFEO. It looked at 5 specific valuations and was described as being as impartial as is possible. Sounds good. Here's the rub, the really impactful point. The submitter alleges AFCA seriously misrepresented what this report actually said. The AFCA case manager apparently stated that while the report did reveal some shortcomings in the valuation, it appears the review concluded the 2007 valuation of $900,000 was supported with the evidence drawn from a wide range of sales. So basically, AFCA presented this independent report as if it found no major red flags and kind of supported the bank's valuation.
Right. And this is really the aha moment, isn't it? The critical detail that shows the alleged discrepancy, maybe even misdirection by AFCA, because the submitter directly contrasts AFCA's summary with the actual conclusions of that independent expert. The expert actually found the Property Pro report format used was inappropriate for large land parcels, that it severely limited communicating critical risks to the bank. They also specifically noted that the on globo valuation method, you know, valuing a big chunk of land all at once, not breaking it down, could lead to underreporting of market risks, unquote. And most strikingly, the expert explicitly said that BOQ's risk analysis did not respond at an early stage to this mainly unexplained increase in value, unquote. Now, that directly contradicts AFCA saying the valuation was supported and there were no red flags in the bank's process. It's a huge concerning difference between what AFCA said the report found and what it apparently actually found.
Wow. Okay. And the submitter then hammers home another crucial point, this time about the actual lawfulness of the valuation itself. Apparently, BOQ's valuer, Propel National Valuers, admitted the $900,000 valuation was based on potential value and was subject to council approval. It wasn't critically based on the value of the land at that date. Now, the submitter argues this goes against the long-standing legal precedent, Spencer v. the Commonwealth, which basically defines market value as what a willing buyer pays a willing seller right now, not based on potential. Basing it on potential, the submitter claims, makes it unlawful from the start. And then adding to these issues, the final determination on this complaint. It arrived an incredibly untimely 630 days after the first complaint was filed. That's almost 2 years. And the outcome, well, it was substantially in favor of the bank, just upholding that preliminary view.
Yeah, and this is where the allegations get even sharper, leading to this really serious accusation that the AFCA panel engaged in gaslighting. This is a specific example given. The panel stated the complainant's claims of price gouging were unsubstantiated, except the complainants say the term price gouging was never used or implied by them at all. And the submission defines gaslighting here as denial, misdirection, contradiction, and falsity in an attempt to destabilize the complaint and delegitimize valid facts that are supported by contemporaneous documentation. That's a really critical, hard-hitting claim. It suggests it wasn't just error, but potentially a deliberate tactic to dismiss concerns by, well, twisting what was even said.
Right. And moving beyond just that one, albeit very detailed, case study, the submission alleges AFCA systematically failed to consider several other crucial arguments in its final determination. And these were arguments that were apparently highlighted in the submitter's response to the preliminary assessment. These weren't minor points either. They included fundamental legal things like Spencer v. the Commonwealth, which we just talked about. They also included key industry practice standards like the Australian Bankers Association's own submission on using truly independent external valuers. And good industry practice, defined by APRA Prudential Standard APS 220 Credit Risk Management, which is a key standard for how banks should manage credit risk. The submitter notes none of these major points were even mentioned, let alone addressed, in the final determination. And this omission, they claim, leads to the accusation that AFCA breached its own rule A.14.4, which says determinations must be in writing with reasons. If you don't give reasons for ignoring key arguments, is it really a reason to determination?
So just to recap what they apparently missed or overlooked on the valuation side, because it's quite a list. There's the core maladministration and lending, loan management, and security matters claim that should have been central. The submission also mentions a contemporaneous document written at the time that allegedly warned about overvaluation and specifically asked that a certain valuer not be used. Plus, there's the pretty damning detail that the Bank of Queensland itself was actually suing the same valuer, Propel National Valuers, in court for other unrelated overvaluations done around the same time, down 11. Yet despite knowing this, BOQ allegedly didn't tell its customers, including this complainant, about potential loan-to-valuation ratio LVR breaches caused by Propel's questionable valuations. And an LVR breach, you know, where your loan is suddenly worth more than your property, that can trigger a real crisis for borrowers.
Yeah, and it gets even more complex, doesn't it? Because the borrower in this case, according to the submission, never actually missed a payment. They always assured they could keep paying. But they still got, quote, unwittingly trapped by a non-monetary LVR breach. So not defaulting on payments, but the property value collapsed, leaving them stuck with no way to refinance elsewhere. And apparently, even an offer from the borrower to refinance, which lined up with BOQ's own internal assessment of net return, was just ignored by the bank.
And beyond those primary valuation issues, the submission briefly touches on a set of secondary issues. And these are described as problems that only really came up because of that fundamental overvaluation issue at the start. Things like AFCA allegedly failing to consider the lack of credibility of the BOQ officer and their agent, the broker. It's also claimed AFCA ignored or dismissed contemporaneous documents about important meetings and signings, while at the same time apparently just accepting BOQ's side of the story despite a complete lack of any contemporaneous document from the bank to back it up. And then there's the claim AFCA accepted an incorrect and unlawful inclusion of another entity to justify serviceability for the loan, even when its own internal assessment went against that. You see this pattern emerging, don't you? Disregarding evidence from one side, accepting unsubstantiated claims from the other, it strongly suggests a potential bias towards the financial institution.
So stepping back, what does all this mean for the bigger picture? For financial justice in Australia, the submitter's conclusion is, well, incredibly hard-hitting. They state AFCA is 100% industry-centric, with no real and meaningful consumer input or participation at any level of the AFCA structure. And the really concerning implication here is that this structure, quote, opens AFCA to bias in favor of industry, be it conscious or unconscious. It suggests a fundamental systemic problem, potentially woven into the fabric of how these disputes are supposed to be resolved impartially.
Yeah, and the submission goes even further than that. It alleges that AFCA spin creates an illusion, and it does so with impunity. Impunity, why? Well, precisely because AFCO's determinations are final. For you, the consumer, there are basically no accessible ways to appeal or fix what the submitter calls a dodgy determination. And this creates this profound, almost inescapable dilemma for people with complaints. They go to AFCA because the courts are too expensive, totally out of reach of the average person. So the submission argues it's just disingenuous and deeply unfair for AFCA to then turn around and suggest that the only way to fix their allegedly flawed determinations is to go back to those same unaffordable out-of-reach courts.
Exactly. And the final really damning claim in this section is that an unfair industry-centric culture of acting with impunity has been allowed to be rolled over from FOS, that's the old Financial Ombudsman Service, and or develop right inside AFCA itself. This culture, the submitter argues, directly breaches AFCA's mandatory requirements and contradicts that original ministerial belief that the scheme would operate fairly. It's an allegation of something deeply entrenched, a culture problem, not just, you know, a few isolated mistakes. So as we wrap up this deep dive, it's really clear this submission raises significant and frankly deeply concerning questions about how financial complaints are actually handled in Australia, about the integrity of the whole resolution process. It's been an unflinching, critical look at an institution that's meant to be a last resort, a beacon of fairness for consumers. We've explored these core allegations that AFCA, despite its legal duty to be fair, efficient, timely, and independent, is seen by the submitter as consistently delivering outcomes that favor industry over consumers. And this is allegedly done through a pattern of, well, misinterpreting its own rules, disregarding crucial evidence, and perhaps a broader systemic bias.
Which really raises an important question for all of us, doesn't it? And maybe for the whole future of financial dispute resolution. If the very body designed to be the accessible last resort, the place you go when you have nowhere else to turn for financial grievances, faces such strong, detailed allegations of bias, misrepresentation, and outcomes you just can't challenge, what does that ultimately mean? What does it mean for the basic principles of justice and accountability, within our financial systems. You know, how crucial is truly independent and transparent dispute resolution for keeping public trust in financial services? And what happens when that trust, once it's eroded, becomes incredibly difficult, maybe impossible, to fully restore? It's a vital question, I think, for every consumer and certainly for the regulators who oversee these critical services.